thank you, Brother Jim, and thank you, Brother Walter. It's good to be back in Huntsville, and I bring you love and greetings from your brethren in Connecticut, New London, Connecticut, also from the Southwest Florida Ecclesia, a very small ecclesia there, wants to send love and greetings. And also my daughter and her husband, Dawn and Russell Shalhoub. She reminded me several times, so she must have some kind of warm feeling for the brethren here in Huntsville, as well as all the other brethren. Fault finders are still with us among the brethren. They're around us. They're among us. They're within us. Complainers are fault finders. They complain about the fault of others. They complain about almost everything they encounter. Complainers are often addicted to their practice. That is, they engage in fault finding with an easy, natural tendency. Have you ever wondered why that tendency is easy? We're going to talk about some of these things. Fault finders that deal with other persons' faults more often look at the petty, the small, the trivial, and the insignificant imperfections. That's right. We have imperfections. You have imperfections. We all have imperfections. I have them. We're loaded with them. Small little things. Anybody here that's perfect, stand. Then you agree with me. We take surveys like that once in a while. There's only one person that was perfect and he lived 2,000 years ago. So let's say it and say it right. We're imperfect. At least our human nature. Fault finders are usually complainers. That's a very important way to establish a fault finder. They're always complaining. Complainers are individuals who gripe incessantly, but who never try to do anything about what they're complaining about. Because either they feel powerless to do so, or because they refuse to bear the responsibility that's required. You know, by definition, a fault is a defect, an imperfection, a flaw, a shortcoming, an error, a mistake. It can also be the failure to do what is right. But you know, most dictionaries, both religious and secular, tend to emphasize that faults are small by nature, petty, little. They're not big sins. Killing is a sin. That's a big one. We don't think of killing as a fault. Adultery is a sin. It's a big sin. But we don't think of adultery as a shortcoming. Saying an unkind word, we don't think of that as a sin. We think of that as a fault. Not given to hospitality, that's not a sin, more of a fault. So, you know, I'm trying to separate the sins from the faults. Fault finders, for a variety of reasons, which we're going to suggest shortly, thrive on the blemishes of others. Fault finding and complaining seems to fill some kind of need. And brethren, are you a fault finder? Do you have that natural tendency to thrive on the blemishes of others? Fault-finding and complaining seems to permeate our entire fellowship. And you must answer, are you a fault finder? Do you have this natural tendency? Do you find some kind of satisfaction to reveal the faults of others and to complain about them? You know, there have been many instances of fault finding in the scriptures, just to cite a few. Remember Judas in John 12, 3-6? Who found fault and complained about Mary pouring costly perfume on the feet of Jesus. Remember that incident? He complained. He said, the money should be given to the poor. Well, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Give it to the poor. You remember what Jesus said? Then remember the scribes and the Pharisees in Luke 5, 29-30, who found fault and complained to Jesus about eating and feasting with the tax collectors and the sinners. Why are you eating with the sinners? Come with us. As if they weren't sinners. Sort of a condemnation by association. Then remember the hired laborers in Matthew 29-12 who complained they were only given one denarii for working all day over those who were given one denarii for working only 1 hour. Remember the Israelites as fault finders in Numbers 11:13-15. When Israel left Egypt, the Israelites, they complained and found fault with the leadership of Moses and Aaron. You know, friends, the complaints of the Israelites were so severe against Moses that it affected him so much that Moses asked to die. Moses, who miraculously freed them from the Pharaoh. Moses, who miraculously led them out of Egypt. Moses, who led them across the Red Sea. Moses, who was the great leader of Israel, was barraged and picked on unmercifully by the Israelites. Complaining by the complainer is a deadly stress to the complainee. There's a powerful lesson here, friends. When you find fault and complain, you could destroy the person you're complaining about. With the consecrated, you could destroy the spirituality of a spirit begotten. So we're not talking about something trivial. The Israelites complained so much to Moses that Moses prayed to God to kill him. Isn't that something? Is it conceivable, friends, that the great liberator felt so bad in the face of his fault finders that he asked God to kill him? There's a lesson here, friends. The effects of fault-finding on the faulty. Finding faults, emphasizing faults, complaining about faults, murmuring about faults can crush us, can discourage us to despair. It happened to Moses, and it can happen to us. The Israelites complained so much, found so much, that they began to find fault with God. They complained about God to God. Now, friends, you can complain about me, and you can complain about her, and you can complain about him. You can complain about the elders. You can complain about the ecclesia. But you got to be careful when you complain about God to God. From that incident, Many Israelis lost their lives from the hand of God for fault finding. From that incident, all those 20 years old and older complained, never saw the promised land. You know, you ever wonder why it took 40 years to go from Egypt to what we would call Palestine or Canaan? You wonder why it took 40 years? You know, a trip that could take 2 months. 2 months, that's all right. I want to be liberal, 6 months. 40 years it took. Did God lose the way? Didn't God know how to get there? What was happening? God was losing them. He was moving them around in circles. Why? All those fault finders, 20 years and old, were to die. They were not permitted to go into the promised land. That's why it was 40 years. Does that say something to us? Is there a lesson there about complaining about the conditions that God has given us, that is arranged for us, complaining about how the Lord is leading us? They never saw the promised land. Again, friends, that's a powerful lesson to us. You know, Jesus gave us this powerful lesson about fault finding when he said in Matthew chapter 7, verses 3 and 5. Let me quote that to you. And why beholdest thou the mote? You know, a mote is a splinter. Why beholdest thou the splinter that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull the splinter out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast the beam out of thine own eye, and thou shalt see clearly to cast the splinter out of thy brother's eye. A splinter is a small speck. So small you can't see it. This refers to the small faults. Because we're imperfect. The small weaknesses with our brethren. A beam is a large piece of wood, literally consists of thousands and thousands and thousands and maybe millions of splinters. Jesus, why are you interested in taking a splinter out of your brother's eye when you got millions of splinters in your own eye? Now let me demonstrate this. I got a splinter right over here. Right here. Carol, can you see that? Joanne, can you see that? That little splinter I got? You can't. Can you see that beam there? Carol, can you see that beam? Was Jesus making a point? Let's examine what Jesus was saying. Let's look at these scriptures in Matthew 7, 3 to 5. False exists in every one of us. No one is exempt. We are all imperfect. Remember Psalms 51, 5? We are born in sin and shapen in iniquity. Some have more and some have less, but we all have faults. And there's nothing profound or skillful in seeing the faults of people. They are obvious. They are noticeable. They are easily seen. But notice, Jesus says, before you look for the splinter in your brother's eye, consider the beam in your own eye. We might ask, well, who's the one that's got the splinter and who's the one that got the beam? Now, if all of us apply that scripture to us, we discover what Jesus is really saying. He's saying we all have beams. That's what he's saying. This is a brilliantly conceived statement about Jesus. What Jesus is really saying, we all have beams in our eyes. Many faults, huge faults, never-ending faults. There isn't anyone who has the tiny speck so small that you can hardly see it. And since we all have beams, we should stop complaining about them. Fault finder sometimes loses their charity toward the faulty. He sees the worst in an individual rather than the best in the individual. And we're not able sometimes to separate the fault from the faulter or separate the sin from the sinner. But we must develop that skill. You know, one of the great lessons the Lord is developing within us is the ability to separate the sin from the sinner. If you're going to handle the thousands of resurrected individuals, do you think they're going to come out or come back perfect? They're not coming back perfect. Oh, they'll come back whole. They'll come back complete. But they're going to have the same attitudes, the same imperfections, the same conditions they had before they went in the grave. There's no change in the grave. So we have to deal with these people. I might say sinners in the sense that they bring their past with them. And then we have to start working with them, helping them back to the highway of holiness. Can we work with sinners? If you say, I can't, how is the Lord going to employ you? You know, we like to think that the Lord is an employer, and He is. If you can't separate the sin from the sinner, how are you going to help the sinner? We got to develop those skills, those judgmental skills. Stop the sin, correct the sin, remove the sin, but to help the sinner, to encourage the sinner, to aid in the salvation of the sinners. That was the mission of Jesus in the first advent, and we should never forget that. Sometimes we get lost in the intricacies of chronology. And sometimes we get lost in the complexities of Levitical procedures and forget what it's all about. It's salvation for the sinners. That's what it's all about. That's why Jesus came. That's why He selected His 12 to continue with the mission of salvation for the sinners. That's the great work of the kingdom. Reconciling people back to God. You know, friends, for a long time, this separating of sin from the sinner bothered me. Oh, it bothered me. How can you hate what a man does and not hate the man? You know, I hate killing, but how can I love a murderer? I hate homosexuality, but how can I love a homosexual? I hate abortion, but how can I love an abortionist? I have a difficult time with this and it troubles me. But you know what occurred to me not too long ago? That there's been one man to whom I have been doing this all his life. I hated his behavior, but I loved the individual. I hated his sins, but I loved the person. I hated his faults, but I loved his life. Do you know who that person is, friends? Me. However much I hate my conceit, however much I hate my selfishness, I hate my sins, I hate my shortcomings, I hate my faults, but I go on loving myself. I go on forgiving myself. I don't have the slightest difficulty about it. So I've discovered that I have separated the sin from the sinner. It's because I've loved myself. I was sorry and forgiving for the sort of man that I am. And that's what we must do with our brethren. Separate their faults from the person. Love the person, but not the faults. Let's make a second point that Jesus brings out. Again, we're still commenting on Matthew 7. 3-5. Faults can be easily seen by others. There are two reasons for that, is that we're always looking at the people's eyes. When you see people, you look at their eyes. You don't look at their feet. You know, it's interesting when you meet people for the first time. You know, you go to shake their hand. You don't look at their feet when you shake their hands. Nor do you look at the ceiling when they're shaking their hands. What do you look at when you meet people for the first time? Right in their eyes. At least 99% of people do that. Why do you look at their eyes? This signifies we look at the lives of people. You're looking more than eyes. You're looking at the lives of the people. So when you meet somebody for the first time, you're looking beyond those eyes and you're looking into their lives. We're looking at their behavior. We're looking at their conduct. We're looking at their goals. We're looking at their works. We're looking at their decisions and their relationships and their character. This is normal. You know, it's like David Rice, when I met him for the first time yesterday. You know, "Hi, David." And I looked in his eyes, says, "You're presenting a prophecy seminar." What a challenge that is. I wasn't even looking at the David of San Diego. I didn't even care about the David of San Diego. I was looking at what was about to happen in his life and subsequently in my life as well. There's a second reason. We are striving for perfection. Remember the scripture in Matthew 5:48, "Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now some of you might want to translate, "Be complete as your Father in heaven is complete." I have no problem. Translate however you will. But as your Father is, we are attempting to become like God. We're not becoming God, but we are attempting to become like God. So this makes us sensitive toward faults, both for ourselves and with our brethren. If we are to reach this goal, we will need to know what faults we have and correct them. For each fault we correct is a step we take toward perfection. And friends, we have a big problem here. You correct a fault, you get closer to God. No question about it. But as you get closer to God, more faults are revealed in your nature. Because God is a model. He's the model of perfection. Now, if you want to ignore your faults, stay away from God. Stay away from Jesus. These are models. The closer we get to Jesus, the more faults we have. It's almost like a catch. 22. But Jude 24 states, we must be presented faultless before God. Let me repeat that. Jude 24. We must be presented faultless before God. The more you study God, the perfect model, the more you study Jesus, the perfect example, the more you see differences, the more you see contrast, the more you see faults in yourselves. Every step closer you get to God is a step closer that reveals more faults. The beam gets bigger. The greater the knowledge we have of God, the more perfect our perception. The more perfect our perception, the greater the capacity to be aware of, to see faults. The capacity and to find faults become limitless. And it's for this reason that the psalmist in 19:12 says, as you get closer to God, cleanse thou me from secret faults. Pursue perfection, and you will harvest the existence of a big bean. Let's consider for a moment the white lie. You know, the lie that is clean and pure. I mean, I don't know how in the South over here, you know, we call it a white lie back Northeast. You have it, white lies down here? Maybe not. Well, I'm sure you have another term for them. But the white lie. Some might even call it the justified fault. Is a white lie a justified fault? Now, we know a lie is an untruth, a false statement. A lie that intends to deceive. That's what a lie is, that intends to deceive. When you say a white lie, you're saying a clean and acceptable deceit. What you're saying is a white lie is a justified deceit. If we engage in deceit on a frequent and regular basis, it becomes a lifestyle, a way of living, a style of character. If you see this process, then let me ask you this. Could God give immortality to an individual who would deceive? Could God give an indestructible life to an individual whose normal tendency would be to hide what is truth? Would God do that? I don't think so. And we got lessons. That's why we have the Old Testament with Israel. That's why Israel is given to us, friends. Not given to us for history. And those of you who study Israel from a historical standpoint, that's good. But if that's all you do, you missed it, brethren. We study Israel as lessons for us. That's why it's put in there. To learn. And if those Israelis did not reach the promised land, you can be sure you're not going to be one of the immortals if you continue with the lifestyle of deceit. Deceit diminishes character. Deceit is an agent of sin. Deceit is a sign of apostasy. Deceit is practiced by flattering words, false reports, false reasoning. Deceit can never be justified. Some of you might say, what about Rahab? What about, didn't she utter white lies? And the answer is yes. She lied through her teeth. To save two spies. But Rahab was not spirit begotten. You are spirit begotten. Deceit spots the robe. Rahab was not a Jew and therefore not under the law. You are under perfect law. Deceit is a practice of imperfection. Rahab was not developing a character to be implanted in a spiritual body, into a divine body. You are developing a character to be transplanted. planted. There's a difference between Rahab and us. If we could only see what God is allowing in our lives. We say experiences, and I think many of you will agree with me. Experiences is the greatest thing that's happening to us. Experiences. But friends, that's only half the story. He's allowing experiences, but he's also allowing the test of an experience. Life is a series of tests. That's right. I hope you collect that perception. When you live life, you are living a series of tests. Everything you do, everything you think, everything you say, everything you plan, everywhere you go is a test. It's a test of character. It's a test of readiness. It's a test of development. It's a test of faithfulness. It's a test of Christ-likeness. It's a test of qualifying for the elect class. I hope you haven't got the idea that you're going to run your consecrated life, and then one day, when you meet the Lord, there'll be a test. It doesn't work that way. The test happens the moment of an experience. After each experience, the test. Is the experience compliant to Christ's likeness? Are you failing in your test? Too often we wait for the big test, when in reality it's the small, regular, recurring experiences in life that represents the test. Complaints is a failure of a test. Let me repeat that. Complaints about what God is doing for you and the arrangements he has set down for you is the failure of a test. Complaints is saying to God, I'm dissatisfied with the experiences you are allowing in my consecrated life. Complaints is like the Israelis as they wandered to the promised land. Remember, only 2 out of 2 million of the original group ever entered the promised land. Joshua and Caleb. 2 out of 2 million. Well, if you want to argue the point that women were there and so forth, the children, I won't. I'm talking about men. Only two. And remember, only 144,000 out of 20 billion people will arrive at the house of many mansions. Let's take a third point that Jesus makes and gives us a caution. Fault finding can seriously affect the fault finder more than the faultee. Matthew 6:23. If the eye be evil, then the whole body is evil. The eye, what's in the eye, the beam, can spiritually affect the individual who complains all the time. So when you're complaining about an individual, it may affect you and your condition more than the one you're complaining about. The new creature which is in you, we all know, is the new mind. We have a new mind, friends. And by new mind, I don't mean a new brain. It's the old mind. But being transformed, being renewed, being changed. The new mind is not totally negative, nor is it totally positive. It is both positive and negative. It sees what's right as well as what's wrong. We have a real problem when everything is wrong, and we have the same problem when everything is right, because that's not true, too. We have a sound mind when we're able to see the good as well as the bad, discern the good from the evil. If we look for the worst in our brethren, we will sure to find it. You know, this is a very important point about married couples. Why? Because you live with each other all the time. You know, Mary and I, we're together 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I always encourage her to go places with her friends. Somehow or other, she doesn't want to go. But when you live with somebody 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, day in and day out, 365, you begin to see a lot of things. She sees things in me, wow. But friends, understand this is the natural process. And is there a struggle? Is there a struggle? A big struggle. And then you have the moods of people. You know, sometimes you're in the mood, you pick on people. Sometimes when you're not in the mood, you don't pick on people. But you know, at least with me, I'm always one of those moody people. And so I thought I would take one Sunday morning and collect all of the expressions that were given in our class just to see if there was a fault-finding mood. And here are some of the things that I collected. Where's everybody? Nobody's on time. And then here's another one. Somehow that sister always picks the same hymn. It's the same hymn all the time. She doesn't know any other hymns. The piano player was off key. The music was terrible. And a recent expression, by the way, the new hymn books are too heavy. The elder had a sloppy suit on. I don't like his tie. I hope you like my tie this morning, by the way, Francis. I had one sister one time. I had a favorite tie. You know, it was out on the West Coast. And I wore it. And she came right up to me. She said, "Brother Paul, I don't like your tie." And I looked at that and I said, "Gee, I thought that was a kind of a nice tie." I says, "Would you want me to remove it?" She says, "No, you can keep on it, but don't wear it anymore." Friends, you know, the prayer was too long. Why do people have to pray so long? Why don't they do it in their own time? And then there's the discourse. The brother was too soft. He was too quiet. I couldn't hear him. You know, there was a sister back in Connecticut. Some of you might know her. She's Anna Mae Sarasi's grandmother. Some of you may have remembered her. She was a grand old sister. I think she was about 94, 95 when she passed away. And she would always sit right in front in the auditorium. Every time I was speaking, she would be right in the front. So one day I went up to her and I asked her, I said, "Sister, why do you always sit in the front, right there in front of me?" And she says, "Brother Paul," she says, "you are my favorite speaker." I says, "Oh, thank you, sister. Isn't that a nice thing to say? But why? Why am I your favorite speaker?" She says, "Because you're the only one I could hear." So, if you're in a fault-finding mood, you will find these things. It doesn't take any special skill to fault find. That's why we must be aware of the process, to be careful of it. When you're in a fault finding mood, you're looking for faults and you are sure to find them, but all the while you have the beam in your eye so that you could not see straight. The fault finder is a bad fact finder. Before we criticize others, we must make sure that we have all the facts. If you unfairly judge the behavior of others when we do not have sufficient information upon which to have to make a judgment, we become poor judges. I've seen cases of brethren criticize other brethren for being lazy while actually they were struggling with a hidden deformity. I've seen brethren criticize others for being miserly in giving while actually they were secretly supporting another family. Faults are not always what they appear to be on the surface. And how many times has that happened to you? Those who criticize you without knowing the whole story. There's always three sides to a story. Three sides. Yours, mine, and the right side. Let's move more and more into that right side. Another point from Matthew 7. Faults are irritating and troublesome to the consecrated. Whether you have a beam or a splinter, you will be uncomfortable. Ever have a small speck in your eye and ask someone to remove it? Ever have them say, "I don't see it"? But you say, "It's there, I feel it." Our faults make us uncomfortable. But you know, if you leave that splinter in your eye, eventually it becomes comfortable. I'll never forget Dawn, my daughter. She used to wear these contact lenses. And every once in a while, there's a little particle that will get underneath the lens. And you could feel it. And you have to take that lens out to clean it and so forth. And she was telling me how sometimes she's not able to do that because of a predicament she's in at work or something like that. And she notices that if you leave it long enough, after a while, you don't feel it. And that's so true with faults. You see a fault, you know it's there. And at first, I got to get rid of it. And then eventually, it becomes so comfortable that it becomes part of your lifestyle. Be ye perfect is our goal. We reach for it. We strive for it. We sometimes fail. We get frustrated. We're disappointed. It produces anxieties. But it's with these disappointments and these frustrations and these perplexities and these unattainable abilities that causes some problems as we look at brethren. I would suggest that it might even be the reason why there's a normal tendency to find fault in our brethren. Fault finding in others is a tendency because we recognize these faults so well in ourselves and the error of others we have in our own life. We spot them easily because we know we have them. It even builds our ego up by looking at the faults of others. I got 5 faults, but I see you got 10. Hey, you're in worse shape than I am. Somehow it makes us feel good to know he's in worse shape than I am. And we often forget we can never build ourselves up by tearing down our brethren. You build yourself up by building up your brethren. You know, if you help your brother to cross the stream, lo and behold, you too have crossed. Sometimes fault finding in our brethren often results from imposing a high expectation of our brethren. A high expectation. Elders shouldn't have imperfections. I'm not perfect, but an elder should be perfect. We expect perfection in others while we tolerate imperfection in ourselves. The complaints we hear about elders is sometimes unmerciful. Complaints upon complaints upon complaints. Friends, if you only think about the amount of time and energy and concern and counsel and study and expense that elders render toward their ecclesias, the ecclesia should be grateful they have them. I'm not trying to extol the elders, boast the elders, elevate the elders. I'm only saying honor them that work for you and for the Lord. Encourage them that think about you and serve you spiritually. Cooperate with them that collaborate with projects and other ecclesias. Don't crush your elders with complaints. They have been given to you by God. Moses was crushed by the Israelites. When are we going to learn that lesson? Back in New England, I'll never forget, in our New England convention, one of the young elders put on an audiovisual presentation for the convention. The brother, because he told me, consumed more than 400 man hours to building up that visual presentation. 400 man hours. Now, at the going rate, it was about $20,000 if the ecclesia bought that in terms of dollars and cents. It would have cost them $20,000 for that 1 hour presentation. Did the brethren complain? They sure did. It was too long. Some pictures were inappropriate. Music was too loud. Criticism upon criticism. That young elder says he would never do it again. You know, I've been under stress recently because I travel so much. The thought has been circulating in my ecclesia, I may not get elected as an elder because I'm hardly around. I think Carl has that problem too. Hardly is around. I says, if I don't get elected as an elder, they will save $50,000 a year. I'm only kidding. But what do elders get in their compensation? David, you must be reaching at least $50,000 a year. And Carl, you must be getting at least $100,000 a year. Honor your elders. Honor those who work for you. The scriptures say, honor them. Sometimes we look at our brethren and we wonder, what did God see in them for which he called them? You know, I look at Carl Hagensick and I say, what could God see in him to call him into the high calling? And Carl looks at me and he's saying, good grief, Paul Malley, I can't believe God called you. Let me say this, friends, that God sees every one of us that no one else sees. Something he wants to use, something there's a potential, something that he wants to develop. He doesn't just call you. He calls you for a purpose. He calls you for a position in the body. He's not going to call everybody and say, oh, I wonder what I'm going to use them for. He calls you for a purpose, for a role, for a position in the body. And if God calls us, we should stop complaining whom God has given to us. Remember Jesus in the prayer of John 17? I thank thee, Father, whom thou hast given me. Did Jesus complain about God selecting the 12? No, he didn't complain. I would like to ask him one day if he thought that they were an appropriate group. Because if I had a selection, if God gave me, and thank God he didn't give me, but if he gave me the mission of picking the 12 apostles of Jesus, I wouldn't have picked those 12. Paul, I would have, maybe. Paul, yes. The apostle Paul is, he fits it. Exactly. But I wouldn't have picked him. But God picked him. And Jesus says, I thank thee for those you have given to me. Can we say the same thing to one another? I thank thee for those you have given to me. God gave you to me and me to you. God gave us each other to encourage one another, to uplift one another, to inspire one another. I don't have anyone else. My family, all my family are Catholics. And we don't meet. Once in a while we do. My neighbors won't talk to me because I have a crazy religion. My colleagues at work stay at a distance because I squawk God. That was written on a piece of paper I put on the bulletin board. He's squawking God. I don't have anybody. I have you. Because God has given you to me. I hope you have the same attitude. We have each other. God has given us to one another. And like Jesus, let's thank God for those he has given to us.